Welcome back to Art Smack. This is episode 20. I'm your host, Matt, and I'm here with...
Cherry Gagosian.
And Hiba Shabazz.
Hiba!
Hey!
Oh my God. Hiba has kindly agreed to join Jerry and I on this very special episode, episode 20.
Wait, did you agree to this?
Or did we just commandeer your studio for an afternoon?
You know, does it matter? Because my space is your space.
There we go. We got a fun episode. We are interviewing and talking with Hiba Shabazz today. It's going to be a blast. Stay tuned. Welcome back to Art Smack.
Welcome back.
So, Jerry, Hiba, where did you guys first meet? What's the story?
How do you, what makes you think I know this bit?
Because you guys are sitting on the couch together, hugging each other and talking about your jewelry. And it's like, clearly you guys have a history. So tell us, what is the history?
We met here in this studio. I mean, not in this studio. I was upstairs, but in the studio building. And Jerry had come over. I feel like I'm calling you Jerry now. Hildy had come over to for Hildy Gallery, was curating a show in Texas. And she'd come to see some paintings. And fast forward to her sitting on this beautiful new table. This was new the day Hildy came over.
The table we're recording on, this thing
this
right
here. Yeah, giant life-size
table. It has your paper.
I think it was 2016.
It's possible.
Yeah.
It's possible.
I think it was 2016.
And
so then how many years is that? I can't do seven. 7 years? 7 years?
She's feeling shy because I'm cuddling her.
Oh, Hiba, where are your hands going?
Oh, my God.
I guess 7 years ago. Yeah.
And then, Hildy, what do you remember from that time meeting Hiba? And what was it about her that made you guys become friends and start working together?
Well, I remember coming in. And well, I remember first I'd seen her work online. And actually on Facebook, which is...
On Facebook?
So cringy to say.
I don't even have an art Facebook.
But Spring Break did. Yeah. And you had participated in Spring Break.
Yes.
And that was in 2015. And I was in San Francisco at the time. This is before... This is probably the year leading into me opening my gallery in LA. And I'd seen your work online and you had done this massive paper your cutouts that you do. And it was, I don't know, hundreds, if not thousands of tiny pieces of paper, of flowers, of birds, of ladies in this room. And I remember feeling like, first of all, your work was very beautiful, which was something that in those times was sort of like rare, or people were sort of just coming out of being able to admit in like the New York art world, like, again, like, beauty is okay. It's okay to love beauty or like beauty or make beautiful objects. And
can I ask, what was being made at that time? What was it predominant?
Well, I'll just back up. When I had been living here in like 2013, it was sort of the end of zombie formalism and people were moving back into something called hard edge abstraction. And that was sort of where and people were actually still making a lot of abstract paintings. There was sort of this new movement, which was figurative painting, was just starting to like cook. But I mean, like, the heat was on low. Like, it wasn't super popular in 2013 when I first left, and I had been gone for two and a half years. And then all of a sudden, I'm watching, like, these figurative painters begin to emerge one by one. And Hiba, who makes figurative work, I was like, okay, she does that, but there's something unapologetically, I don't, forceful is a weird word to use when associated with you, but like sort of you were stubbornly like painting and repainting these beautiful women.
Watch the.
And I was very like drawn to the aesthetic of her work and the colors. I also like that there was a lot of like pink in your work. I liked that there was red. I liked that, I was just very attracted. Like, you just know it when you see it, kind of a feeling. And with very few exceptions in my life have I been like that attracted to somebody's work and then met the person and been like, oh, you know what? I love your work,
enjoy.
But I don't like you. Like, to be that attracted to somebody's work, even from afar, even from online, I was like, I felt, that's probably why I felt like I could just lay on your table when I first met you. But sort of was like, I just felt like I knew we were going to be really good friends.
There you go. Yeah. The second she lay on my table and I found myself photographing this girl I just met, I was like, we're good. Like,
we're good.
This is it. This is a working relationship.
So, Jerry, you called Hiba's work beautiful.
Yes.
You used the word beautiful. Hiba, do you consider your work beautiful?
I think about beauty a lot. Mm-hmm. So I can see it being beautiful. But because I'm so close to it, I probably don't see it being beautiful the way Hildy sees it being beautiful. You know, it's like we're all a little weird about how we look or how what we're doing is. Like, we're all so critical, and at least I am, and constantly judging it.
Well, can I just say, we walked in and the studio is packed with your work. And Hildy and I's jaws are dropping and we're looking around. And you're like, yeah, I'm not happy with these. You're like, these are like bad. And we're like,
these are the bad ones.
These are the bad ones. And it's like this fully beautiful, flushed woman laying. So yeah, you're self-critical in that moment. So what you're just saying, I've seen in action.
But like, okay, I'll be good with maybe 4 paintings in this studio. And the rest of them, the way I see it, are not in a place that I would even consider showing them. Sorry, but sorry.
What makes you, what's the quality of a work that says it's ready to be shown for
I
you?
I just know it's ready.
It's an internal gut feeling.
It's a gut feeling. And what I also realized, because I took some time off to oil paint, I was just learning how to do it, is that flow state when you're painting is really important. Now, if I'm working with a medium, and I don't like to use the word working at all, like I like to think that I don't work,
just unemployed, you're just hanging out. Yeah,
this is the laziest least hardworking artist I've ever met in my life.
I'm just like he's painting is like appeared out of yeah like, finished and fully fleshed yeah out. Yeah,
yeah, it just appeared, like right. It happened by magic. It was an act of creation. I'll call it like devotion, but I can't call it work anymore. But so I feel like work is such a loaded word for too many people. And backtracking to what I was actually saying is that the flow state, when I started painting with oils, I wasn't in the flow state that I was in with watercolor, which is why I didn't show them for a couple of years. Because when I'm in that place, I know that the painting is what it's supposed to be.
Mm-hmm.
And when I'm not in that space, I can finish the painting. Everyone can love it. And I can be like, sorry, this painting is not ready and we can't show it. So part of the final piece is also part of, I include how I feel when I'm making it into whether the painting feels ready or not. And luckily, like just before we all went to Miami because we love Miami so much.
Hell yeah.
You called Jerry, you called yourself Mrs. 305 the other day. And I was like, what? She's like Mrs. Pitbull. That was weird. I don't know why you said that, but
she's cute. She's cute.
And cute like a pit bull.
Dale. So we were all going to Miami right before.
Yeah. And like a month or so before we left for Miami, I finally came into that space where I entered a flow state with the oils.
How did that feel? Oh, was it like triumphant? Was it like fucking awesome?
Amazing.
Yeah, you hit it.
You know, I was just like, oh, thank you, God. You know, because I had a show in 6 months and I was like, at that point, I was like, do I call my gallerist and tell her this is going to be a problem? Or do I like show stuff that I'm not ready to show? Or, and then that moment came and then I was like, oh, life is great. And life is so great after that. Like, I swear, I'm not even joking. I wake up smiling. I'm like, I'm ready to go to the studio. It just like changes everything. So, yeah.
You said that the word work is kind of gratuitously thrown around and people use that. Do you feel like the word, because I do, the word beauty or beautiful is also thrown around in the art world? Like, I feel in galleries and art fairs and museums, a default art speak word is, oh, that's beautiful. That's beautiful. But I feel like what you're doing and what other artists do is they're exploring beauty in some ways. But saying work is beautiful, I feel like, is a different thing. And when I was first studying art history, I was obsessed with Matisse. And I would say he's my favorite artist because the work is beautiful. And this person who was a Christie's specialist and had studied art history and really knew things was like, yes, Matisse explored beauty, but I never saw anything else that he explored. He didn't explore the dark side. Do you think that like art greatness or beautiful art or incredible art needs to not just be beautiful, but also explore other things?
I think beauty for me is more of a feeling. Like if I look at a painting, I'll have this feeling in my heart. I probably won't be like, oh my God, this is so beautiful, but I'll feel something. And to me, that is beauty, more than just a visual representation of it. I do feel like there are words in the art world which get cyclically thrown around. And I think people are in different places where they have different interpretations of what the word beauty means. Like some people have different interpretations of what the word love means. Like for some people, love is romantic. For some people, love is a state you can embody. For some people, love is God. Mm-hmm. I feel beauty is a little bit like that too. It's something that you see and you're visually captured by it, taken by it, moved by it. It's like you look at the sunset and you feel something in your heart and you know that you can take like 200 million pictures of it. And if you're lucky for a few days when you look at that picture, you can capture that feeling, but then the feeling slowly fades away. It's like that Daphne du Maurier book, Rebecca, and she said that, I wish I could make a scent which captured memory. And every time I wanted to relive that memory, I could just open the bottle and smell it. And I feel like beauty is a little bit like that. It's sort of within the moment.
Jerry, what do you think? I'll rephrase it very more clearly. Like, does art that explores only beauty, does it resonate with you? Or do you like to see other elements? I don't know what the question is. Let's just, I'm trying to get to like a point about beauty and art and this idea of like my friend who said that Matisse only explored the beautiful side of art and never went anywhere else. Hmm. And for her, that means that, you know, he had this capped for her. where she felt like, okay, I like some other artists that had a wider exploration. I don't know. Because, Hiba, by all means, your paintings are beautiful, but there's a lot going on here underneath. I mean, at least what I'm seeing.
In my opinion, Matisse was also like that. I mean, when he was doing his cutouts, he couldn't get up.
Right.
There was someone else doing that for him. A lot of people, in my opinion, and I could be wrong because I'm projecting myself, when artists choose to explore beauty, I feel like you can't have one thing without the other. There's nothing in the world which doesn't have a completely opposing force. And so any artist who's focusing on beauty has gotten there through a certain amount of darkness.
Right.
And it's a choice, like, especially when you live in New York. I remember when I moved here, everyone was like, you're painting figures? And like, everything is supposed to be really, really look a little grimy and ugly in artworks. And I was like, ha, what? You know, I was like, I didn't leave my home country to come here so that you start telling me what to do. I'm like, I'm going to do what I want to do, right?
Brett from the Lower East Side, like hard edge abstraction figurative painter.
I was like, don't want you tell me what to do.
Shout out to Brett. He's at Zwerner now. No, I'm kidding.
But yeah.
Yeah. I felt like in beauty school.
You went to B school?
In art school. They, especially if you're, I was in like the new genres. Well, I did a lot of art history. I did way more than the normal prereq of art history that was required because I couldn't like get enough. And I sort of wanted to hear from as many intelligent people all the different versions and iterations of art history that I could in different time periods and stuff. But one thing that I felt like they really prioritized was sort of, at least in my program, and it did infiltrate my brain. And I think a lot of artists probably have gone through this, was like, it's not the final outcome, which I think is sort of what you're saying. But like, it's, well, the way they would always phrase it was like, well, there's ideas behind an artwork. There's the artist's intention, the time, the context within which they made it. There's all these different things that would be like the quote unquote prerequisite for whether or not you're judging whether an artwork is quote unquote good. And even that in the art world is obviously like a very loaded statement. Like, you know, I remember getting screamed at by somebody during a crit because they said, well, why do you like this? Like, you know, because I got so excited. A friend of mine used to make this like really hilarious video art. And I was like, I don't know. It's just, it's really interesting to me. And he's like, it would be the same thing as if I would have said beautiful, right? Like if it's interesting to me, it's beautiful, whatever. There are certain words where you're like, you're not allowed to say that.
Yeah.
More, say more, deeper. About, go further, which is good. I was in school. That was what I was there for, to learn. But I was like, by process of having my brains scrambled and re-scrambled by going to more than one art school, I began to start depriving myself of the pleasure of loving beautiful art, because I thought it was like choogy. It was basic to love beautiful things. And I remember when I was a kid, this is my long answer, but I remember when I was a kid, I used to get these calendars because, you know, we used to use paper calendars, if people remember. But I would always choose my calendar because I liked the art that was in the calendar. Mm-hmm. And I would always get like Renaissance painter calendars, right? And then as a kid, I would cut them out, and my mom would take me to Goodwill or whatever, and I would get like frames for my calendar art, you know. And I curated my bedroom with like rent, and a lot of it was like the fat little cherubs, you know, that were painted, the flowers, the way they painted flowers, a Rubens painting, like these things that I feel like are beautiful. And it was this indulgence that I had. I mean, I had a lot of other weird, I was a weird kid in the sense that
I've seen photos. It was like, it was those calendars. It was Nick Lachey shirtless. It was Britney Spears.
Definitely not. I did not have that kind of bedroom. and it was Johnny Depp, if you want to know, on the back of my door. No, but I had this, I'm talking kid. I was a collector before I was a collector, you know? And I liked these things. Then fast forward, I'm in art school having my brain scrambled, and sort of it was like, especially in the time that I was going to school, which I think was almost like oddly, definitely feeling way more innocent than the current moment. It was like the world was in a good enough place that we were maybe drawn, art at that moment was drawn to exploring darker, edgier themes because like you can't just bask in beauty forever. Like, I don't know. I don't know if that's what it was, but it was like, back then, it was like the edgier, the darker, the closer to something almost like demonic or satanic or filthy or grimy that a work could get to, like the more interesting and, you know, in bunny ears, it could be. And it took me a long time to get over that hangover, where I started giving myself permission to embrace beauty again.
Right. And Hiba, did you feel at that time when these artists that were surrounding you were like exploring darker stuff and you were sticking to your guns? It sounds like you didn't, but did you ever feel any pressure to like go with this crowd in any way? Maybe they were getting shows, maybe they were doing projects in New York, and did you ever feel like, oh, what am I? Should I change?
I've always felt the pressure, but I'm incapable of change because I'm really stubborn, like Hildy said. But that said, for some people, it is their path, and everything is a trend except when it's authentic. So for an artist, if exploring something which is not about beauty, I think that's totally valid, because if that's where they are and what they're meant to do and who they're meant to be, like, I'm not going to tell Goya to go and paint like the water lilies, right? Because it wasn't authentic to him. But I'm not going to tell, you know, the impressionist to like go paint a Picasso either. Right. So it has to be like everything is a trend except for when it's authentic. And I'd like to think that what is authentic will last, but it might not. Like, it might also be a situation in which only the things that fit into that trend and do well are the things that become part of culture or our history, and everything else is erased. So that part has worried me. Like, I've thought about it, but I haven't thought about it enough to change, because I kind of like paint for myself. I mean, I paint for people too, in the way that I like to be conscious of what kind of energy I bring into my space and my art when I'm making it. The other person is going to have to live with that. But I'm not I'm a completely selfish human being. I don't believe in compromise. And
yeah, we had to come record the podcast here. No, I'm kidding.
I paid for myself. I mean, it's just, if I was going to think about what people wanted from me, I would have started painting landscapes when I lived in Karachi and had just had a much very different, in some ways, much easier life.
Do you think about your practice and work? I hate the word work, I know, but your, what was the phrase you used earlier?
Devotion.
Your devotion. Do you think about it, it's looking back on it 50 years from now?
Yeah.
Do you have that kind of long-term thinking about when you're creating? Does that ever come up in your process?
That's a hard, like, it's a hard question. I mean, I would say that I don't think too much about the future. Same as I don't think too much about the past, because, can I say something really corny?
Yeah.
We live in the present, and that's why it's a gift.
Oh, my God.
I think I got that Hallmark card last year, I think. That was a good one. Thanks, Grandma.
They used to say that a lot in AA meetings.
Repeat it one more time, so...
I don't even know if that's the correct line.
No, it is. Like it is. That. It's correct.
We live in the present, and that's why it's a gift.
Yeah. It's not the 100% correct line.
We're paraphrasing Hallmark.
So, okay. I mean, yeah, basically. I write those, don't you?
Heaven Moonlights is a Hallmark card writer.
She writes the two lines that are inside of the card.
Yeah, it was either that or I'm not going to say what else.
So you live in the present.
She knows. She's like, I know what you think. Okay, so there you go. So I do, of course, think a little bit about the past and the future. But here's the thing. Like usually the time when, and I think a lot of artists feel this, but when an artist has a show, everything kind of slows down. Mm-hmm. It's hard to start painting again. And you start thinking, but rethinking. There's this thread of starting something new, but also like not leaving everything behind. Like it's a complex time that you go through because you're in your head. I don't know why it brings you in your head. It's not like my most favorite part about being an artist, but if I start really thinking about the future, and what my future holds, I might freak out. I might start making a lot of decisions which have nothing to do with the painting or with who I am. And I might like enter a trajectory in which I'm kind of doing what I need to do to make sure, or what I think I need to do to make sure to survive, just for my paintings to stand the test of time, to be successful, to make money. And my philosophy as an artist is to put the painting first and then everything else comes later. And this has obviously created some issues where I don't have a very planned life, or I don't ever have a schedule. I never check my email, things like that, like which are logistical problems. Because it pulls me out of my head, it puts me out of my heart, and when I'm in my head, I can't do my best painting.
Right.
Like, I paint much better when I'm in my heart and in a flow state.
I have to have, like, my day planned out, like, in my calendar. That's, like how I think. Yeah. I have, like, call the vet, 8:30 to 8:45, like, eat lunch. Like, I'm psycho like that. So it's fascinating to me that, like... You're kind of like that too.
What do you mean? That I am I a planner or I'm not a planner? I would say I'm a bulldozer.
You plow through things. You plan out your day somewhat, but you also keep a lot of flexibility.
I keep my eye on the ball of whatever ball it is I'm currently trying to catch or throw.
Right.
And then my whole world becomes revolved around.
This is correct.
I'm very goal-oriented, and then I make my whole life about that.
Yeah.
But that, and it's funny because I'm listening to you, and I don't have a like quote unquote visual practice, obviously, like this, but I'm thinking about the all the things that I do and how I think of myself as an artist, and I'm like, I'm mostly in my head, mm-hmm. but I'm stirred by my heart.
Mm-hmm.
That's like what gets me up to work as hard as I do, because we don't have a boss, right?
Yeah.
Like nobody's like, you need to be here by this time mm-hmm. doing this thing, whatever. But like, I know that if I don't get up and push as hard on my writing or on a curating project or on my own artwork or whatever, it's not going to happen.
Yeah.
So then like that is my drive. And maybe that is my heart. I don't know. I'm listening to you and I'm just...
I actually love that you said that because it made me think of dedication, mm-hmm. discipline, drive, devotion. We have 4 D's right here.
The real 4 D's, not death, debt, divorce, and discretion. Those are the fake D's.
Here are the new 4 D's.
The new 4 D's.
Dedication, discipline, drive, and devotion.
Yeah.
And that is also love. I mean, the thing is that some people, everyone is different, right? So some people are more balanced in their head and their heart. I'm not. Like, if I'm in my head, I'm just like, oh, I had anxiety, so I had to start wearing black to protect myself, you know? Like, that's my way of dealing with it. But developing my mind and controlling my head are all things that, like, I'm studying and learning right now. But I'm so used to being in my heart that if my head interferes too much, I can lose my space. For Hildy, what I've noticed is she's like a deeply emotional and in her heart person. But sometimes she thinks being emotional is a bad thing because she'd be like, yeah, I was having this conversation and then I got really emotional. And I was like, so that's okay. Your feelings are important. But she's intelligent and she thinks a lot. And she gets a lot of ideas. But a lot of these ideas, especially the ones that I've seen her get really excited about, come from a place, like a heart place. Like when we did the Matches fashion painting, right. And I come over and she's bawling away because a woman from Ukraine had bought bricks and there was no...
She'd carved... She had... Because they had no bread, but they had...
Yeah.
Stones. She had sanded the stones to look like bread.
Yeah, and she saw that in Venice. And when I met her, she was crying about it. And then she was also talking about this painting for women artists to start a studio program for another woman artist. So that's like a heart, like that's heart centered, but it's translated to her head. And it becomes something that she does something with it.
Mm-hmm.
And that's great. That's like a really good quality. I don't have that quality. Like I can have it here and I can paint it, but I can't really write about my work, my paintings. I don't talk that much about them. I mean, it's very hard for me to articulate what I'm thinking or feeling. I can mostly just express it through either like cuddling her right now, like I forced her to sit in my lap as soon as she walked in, or by painting it. And that's like the difference, I think, between us.
What's the longest you've ever been away from the studio or gone, or not this studio, but maybe gone from painting or creating?
I guess maybe if it's the longest trip, it would probably be 3 weeks or around that month.
But even in between shows, right? So you poured out everything you had for a project. It's shipped. It's there. It's hung. You go to the opening. At what point does the does your brain start to say, okay, I got to create more? Is it immediate? Or does that take a time? Is there like a, I don't know, it's almost like you're doing a huge project and like you deserve a break. Like, can you do that? Can you separate yourself from it? Or are you just right back in? Hildy's laughing. Like, I just asked a bad question.
No. Answer. Sorry. I don't want to insert words.
It's not that. It's just that it's that sometimes even before the paintings have left for the show, once I know what's going, once it's mostly done, my mind switches off or it switches to something new. Which is why exhibitions can be sometimes hard because you're standing there with work, with art, which you're not engaging with the way you engage with it.
Right.
And so it's hard to sometimes, be even in that zone during a show because you've in your mind, like if you can see the next painting, that's where I want to be. But the part of being a professional artist is that you hold it. You hold it back and then you go to your opening.
Right.
And you stand by your paintings and you listen to what the world says about them. You accept that feedback. And so that can sometimes, I mean, it's always a little different.
Do you feel like in those moments that you're kind of like, ready to turn the page that opening night on the works that are hung on the wall?
It's usually before the opening
night. Yeah, so you're, as soon as the works are out, you're like, you're done.
Sometimes I think like the interviews for shows should be a month before the show.
Show
is up, you know, you might have emotionally stepped away from it when the paintings leave the studio. And then you're supposed to go back in and talk about it. And when you are not like a big mental or speaker, like I can speak best when I'm in that emotional space because I know that I'm there so I can speak about it. But once it's gone, I forget about it. Like it passes, right?
So, forget about it.
So for the people listening at home, so what you're saying to me is, even in those moments where you're standing in the center of your solo exhibition in Paris, being shown by one of the world's greatest art dealers and one of the most beautiful galleries in the world.
She's beautiful herself, too.
And she's beautiful herself. What's up, Almin? So you mean you're not just like done? For the day, you're not just like, well,
I'm taking a vacay.
Job well done. I'm going to go to Saint-Tropez now for the next 3 months with my big bag of cash. I wonder this because I know there are different people that have different feelings about work. And I know for you, every time I call you in the morning, I know you're either meditating or you're on your way to the studio or you just got to the studio. Like I should just probably know by now, like your actual quote unquote non-schedule, but it is a devotion, right? You're here all the time. And I also know another painter. Doesn't matter who it is. It's just another dear friend of mine who cannot handle the idea of vacation or being away from their studio, not because they're a workaholic for like money reasons or anything like that, but because this act called painting is for them so deeply ingrained in their personality, their psyche, their emotional sort of balance, their well-being, that, I mean, I've seen the poor guy on like a 3-day vacation and he's stressed the fuck out. And I'm like, can you just chill? Like, I never get to see you. Can you just hang out for a minute?
You're talking about Hunter Biden, right? Just so we're clear.
Talking about my dear friend, Hunter Biden. Hey,
he works. He can't stop working.
Can't stop working. He uses a drug to help him not. No. It's not Hunter Biden. But this friend, they are visibly uncomfortable if a vacation goes past 3 or 4 days. And I have asked on multiple occasions sarcastically. I know what the answer is. I've known him since he was 18. But I'll be like, what's the rush? Where are you trying to go? He's like, I got to get back to the studio, man. I'm like, I know, but dude, you just painted a whole solo show. Can you have more than 3 days? And I've tried so hard, like, to talk him into it. Like, it'll be like negative degrees in New York, like sleeting and shitty. And his studio is like not the warmest place on the planet Earth and like not well insulated. And then I'm like, come to LA, bro. Like, stay in my guest room. Like, you can paint from there. But and he can't. And how, I mean, would you say that you have a similar feeling about your devotion?
It can be really hard to be away from the studios for a long time period. I feel like I've tried to become better at it. But it is a balanced thing. Like, I'll become a little bit crazy. And that's not like, oh, she's so mild. If she becomes crazy, it's okay. I mean, I'll become a crazy person. if I haven't painted
she's
in a long
lying.
Time. So it's for everyone's safety. But I have a studio in Karachi.
Okay.
Which is where I have my longest, I go for the longest amount of time to see my family. I have a studio there. And I had a system in which I would just put my paints in my trolley and just take them with me. But the last time I did that, there was this immigration officer in Karachi who confiscated all my watercolors because I only travel with hand carry. I don't check in luggage. And they all went in the trash. And after that, I was like, I'll never
are you
do that.
What rationale did he give to throw those away?
I don't know. He said, you can't take these. And I was like, I do this like 4 times a year. And he's like, no, sorry.
Oh, my God.
So I can like take really tiny things with me in my hand carry. But I can paint places that are not my studio. Like, that's why I love residencies. The thing about painting in the studio all the time is if you're me, you're surrounded by your own work. And so sometimes painting in a new place means that you shift. You shift, the paintings shift. So that's really, it can be like, now this sounds wrong because obviously it's not a vacation then, but it can be like an accelerated growth for a painter to paint in a new place.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes residencies are like so much, they're so taxing because you're painting all the time and you want to make the most of the time you're there. But great things happen and occasionally terrible things happen, but you learn from them. The mistakes, quotation marks, that we make in art, our failures inform what we do, which is why oil painting was such an easy thought, because I was like, okay, I went into it with the mindset that this is going to fail radically because I'm a watercolorist. And the second thought was, but you want to do it and it'll inform your watercolor. That was my bar for oil painting when I started doing it. So yeah, it can be torturous and it can be okay. But yeah, when Hildy said to me, she said, come to Connecticut for 2 nights. My first thought was, that's too long away from the studio. Maybe we could do one night.
No. We're going to do
an afternoon.
We're going to do, I'm going to come get you a night, a full day. You sleep and then I drive you back the next day. So it's like a day and a half.
Okay. I can accept this. And then we'll go in the garden and paint for part of that.
Okay. I have a question.
Yes. Anything, my love.
Okay. Have you ever destroyed one of your own artworks? And if so, what did that feel like? And can you go into as vivid a detail as possible?
On purpose?
Yes.
Like in a movie style. Like shredding it, like spitting on it, smoking a cigarette and putting it out on it. Like,
have you ever... I'm trying to imagine this. I have gotten rid of art that I don't love. I don't know if I've destroyed it in a super passionate manner.
What do you mean gotten rid of? Like thrown it in the trash?
Yeah.
And so what was that like? Were you like, goodbye, you little cunt? Like, were you like mad at it? Or were you like...
Well, how does that feel like?
I was like, I need space in my studio and you're not good enough.
Wow.
Yeah.
And so then, like a survivor or something.
Like, and then like, then the gentleman, he's passed away now. Art Guerra, who started Guerra Paints, who's down here, found it in the trash, brought it to the studio and made me sign it.
Aww.
And then he kept it. That's one example that I can remember.
He sold it? I'm just kidding.
Yeah.
But there have been times in my life when, as you can see, I tend to accumulate a lot of paintings because of whatever reasons. And then I'll go through phases when I'll just like start giving them all away. There are times when I've gotten upset when something is too fragile, like with the cutout. It was really hard when I was in the upstairs studio, which Hildy visited. It was maybe half the size of this, and I was doing cutouts and like 10-foot paintings. So things were getting wrecked. Things right. get wrecked on a daily basis. I mean, how can they not? But that time, the cutouts, when they would tear, and I would try to salvage them and keep them, one day I just like took them all and ripped them apart and put them in the trash. But there's something hard for me about doing anything to harm the female body psychologically. Mm. So even with that, like getting rid of those cutouts were difficult because I wanted to be very clear in my mind that I was not like deliberately trying to hurt the body. I don't know. That's weird, right? But it's just... It's how I feel. Like, I feel like just myself having gone through like a delicate physical state at time. When I handle the paper, the cutouts, and it's already painted as a woman, I always try to handle it with care.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So
I would imagine like if your soul got embedded on these objects at some point in your life, whether you've now changed and you want to leave that in the past, that it's difficult just to put it in the trash. Like, I would imagine. And similarly, I'd also imagine when you have work spread across the studio that you are ready to not toss, but just put aside and open up something new. If they're staring at you all day, every day, as you're trying to explore something new, that could probably be pretty difficult. Like, just to get that specter, those ideas, if they're reminding you of all the time of where you've been, how will you know about a new place that you're going or yeah. visualize that? So I guess that's to your point about the residencies. Like, it allows yeah. you just to clear up your space.
Yeah. Because, like, even with these, I know that half the paintings in the studio are never going to be shown. I know that. It doesn't matter whether they can be sold or whatever.
Right.
They're just not going to be shown, at least not while I'm alive.
And, the retrospectives.
even with some of the paintings here, like that painting back there with the green leaves, that is truly a bad painting. I mean, I don't say that about a lot
we're gonna,
of paintings.
We're going to put a photo online for the audience judge if it's a bad now.
The paperwork of that was actually very solid, but I don't
the lion one?
Yeah.
You've been saying that about the lion.
And it's still there. And now at this point, I'm like, I'm going to get the guy and he's going to take off the canvas. He's going to put on a new one. And I don't want to know what happens to this canvas. Like, I will discard it in a second without thinking, oh, this is like a 10-foot painting. Hildy's like, you can give it to me. And I'm like, you don't want that painting. It's just not a good painting.
I liked it, but I remember seeing the work on paper and seeing you struggle with that one. And it's funny because I'm very biased because I have long-term friendship with you. And I admire your work. So I don't have this thing, but actually if you let Hibba, if you go into Hibba's mind, if you get on the roller coaster, which is Hibba's mind, and you let her sort of start telling you in great detail what is wrong with the painting, which she did to me about, it's funny, I can only see about 1/10 of the painting, you guys, but she pointed and said that one there with the leaves, and I just intuitively knew it's the lion painting. Once you started pointing out everything that was wrong with that painting, quote unquote wrong, I was like, yeah, I could see that.
Yeah.
But that's because I let you sort of persuade me. Because prior to that, I was looking at it and
Hibba's
was like,
mouthing, it's bad, it's bad.
I thought it was on its way to being just as good as the paper piece that came before it. But to be clear to anybody who's not extremely familiar with Hibba's work, Hibba is a watercolorist first who painted on paper for years and years and years and years. And oil painting is very, very, it's like a blip on your radar, right? Like it's 2 years old, 3 years old,
maybe four now.
Okay. But still like pretty new.
Yeah.
I'm not an artist, and this is going to come as an obvious answer to a lot of people listening, but just for me, what are the challenges with working with oil paint versus other mediums?
So with the oil paints, I mean, what's interesting to me is that a lot of oil painters have told me watercolor is so difficult. And I think part of it is different people are familiar with different things. Like watercolor is a medium that you put a layer and you can't cover it mostly.
Mm-hmm.
It's there. And with oil, you can go over it many times. For me, the challenge was firstly trying not to treat the oil paint as watercolor. Like the first oil painting I made, I think it had like 10 layers of red on it because I made the red so thin. I diluted it so much with like turpentine and all this stuff that was like water, but it shouldn't have been. And then the second challenge was that after painting that painting and being drowned in turpentine for an extended time period, I became tachycardic because I realized I'm allergic to turpentine, a lot of petroleum stuff, which is in the quick dries.
Right.
So I had to take like almost a few weeks off. I was so sick, maybe even a month, and come back to it. But I streamlined it so that it's just oil paint and oil and sometimes spiked lavender.
And that takes forever to dry.
It does. So like Hildy's wet painting has been realized, like the concept of a painting leaving the studio
wet. Painting.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's like, yeah, it's impossible to dry. I mean, it's not impossible, but it has a longer drying time than most other pigments.
So you don't use some of these chemical agents that would make it dry quicker?
I don't use any of them because I just like physically my body can't handle them.
Wow.
And so my process with oil is much slower.
Mm-hmm.
But also in the way that I work, in the way that I'm painting with oil, like this painting has looked the same since the Armory show last year. I haven't touched it. but I know I will touch it. Like I know that there is some potential in this painting, even though it's not where I need it to be right now. I had a pretty major collector who came in and who wanted it as it is, but I don't think it's ready. And I think it will be ready, just not ready today.
How do you tell a collector that, you know?
Say it's not ready.
And they just say, yes, okay. Just let me know when it is. Or they go, well, no, I think it's ready. Like, it's okay. I mean, I'm looking at you and you're like, fuck them. Like, I don't care what
they say.
No,
it's not that. It's just, it's...
I get it.
I just say it's not ready. I mean, but I say it's not ready a lot. Like, I remember going to this dinner where one art dealer who I was occasionally working with told another art dealer, well, you walk into Hiba's studio and you're like, here's a show. And she's like, it's not ready. And then you're like, let's have a two-person. And she's like, it's not ready. She's like, well, what do you want to do? And she says, you can have one painting.
the ready one.
The one that's ready. But of course, if there is a show, the paintings will be ready. But sometimes I need to let a painting sit and then come back to it later because I'm either can't see it as clearly as I want to, or I'm too close to it, or it just needs to bake. Sometimes I'll think a painting is terrible and a year later I'll be like, okay, that's not that bad.
You don't say it's great. It's just, it's not that bad.
Oh, yeah. I mean, great is like a difficult bar for me to read.
Well, I was thinking about our phone conversation. I'm not gonna act naively like I'm asking Hiba something I don't already know about, but we were on the phone and we were talking about how to achieve greatness at anything, and there's the how many hours 10, is 000. It
10,000.
Robert Greene, baby.
Okay, 10,000 hours. Okay, I have many more hours to go.
It's Malcolm Gladwell. Well,
it's Malcolm Gladwell.
Yeah,
is that who came up with the theory?
That's where I first read it, in one of his like airport books.
Yeah, but who knows if it was him?
There's this guy whose name is Robert Greene, who did like the laws of power and stuff, the laws of seduction. And he wrote a book on mastery as well. And I think in that he'd said 10,000 hours. But there's probably other people who've said the exact same thing. And yeah. It's true.
Totally.
It's totally true.
Yeah. Do you feel that you've hit 10,000 hours yet, at least with the watercolor?
Oh, for sure.
And that you're at least there.
I think I hit 10,000 hours with the miniatures. I hit 10,000 hours with the watercolors. I don't think I've hit 10,000 hours with oil. But that makes me kind of happy. Like that I was actually thinking about this in a calculating way. I was like, does the watercolor time count with the oil paint? Like, can I like transmute some of those watercolor hours into just experience with painting that become part of those 10,000 hours? Is that why I finally feel like I'm in the flow state? Or am I still waiting for something? And then I was like, no, that's great, because I'm waiting for the 10,000 hours. Then something great is going to happen.
Right.
And I can look forward to it.
Do you ever look at other artists' work and think that looks like underdeveloped painting? Or I see the origins of a great painter there that never sort of explored the 10,000 hours, maybe put in 2,000 hours or...
And then struck a chord with a certain style and then just, you know.
I have seen an artist's work where I have felt that. I have felt like they could have explored something further, and then they mainstreamed and then everything became that thing, you know, because that can also happen, which it is scary, a little scary for any artist, I think. But to their credit, they did explore some different subject post that. And by now they've definitely put in the 10,000 hours or whatever they were making with it. It even feels a little different now. When it comes to artists, there are artists who love to paint and who love to explore. And then there are possibly artists who are more purpose-driven, who want to get from one place to the other. And getting to the other place is more important than this process. And every time, like, a younger artist ever asks me about to look at their work or to sort of give them advice, the one thing that I always say is you have to put in the time. Like, you can't make 5 paintings and then say, but why am I not there? You know, or like, the world is so unfair, or whatever it is that's happening in your head, or like, start thinking about the end goal. Like, the time that you have when you are a younger painter to, before you start showing, is like, it's all your time. It's just pure exploration time. It's like, there's no one who's gonna disturb you, tell you what to do, maybe not even care about what you're doing. And that's really the time you can take those strides to become who you're meant to be. But if you don't put in those times because you're just trying to be someone else, you really, like, you lose so much. Like, you lose so much energy in trying to figure out how to get to where you think you're supposed to be because of something that the world has dictated to us. So I always say, like, it doesn't matter if you're making something which is completely unsellable, quote unquote, or just like ridiculous, or no one else believes in it. If it's real to you, you have to go through it. You have to get to where you're going, and you have to, once you've made it, like, once you build it, they will come. I really believe that. I mean,
feel the dreams.
Look at Hildy. Secretly builds this meme account. And then years later, she's sitting here and she's like, oh, you know, I have an account and it's got memes on it. And I'm like, me? But she's like, yeah. She's like, it's called Jerry Gagosian. And I'm like, okay. And I open it and I'm like, but it's private. And she's like, yeah, you have to follow it to see it. And she takes out her phone and she starts showing it to me. And my head exploded. I was like, wow. She built it, right? Like, she could have sat there and she could have thought. She could have thought about it. She could have not put in the time. But she built it, and then everyone came. And that, I think that's pretty much how you build anything.
It's true.
Yeah.
I think all disciplines of life, too.
Yeah.
I mean, it really is about putting in the work. Like, I think it's easy, I think, with online, social media, even things like Uber and food delivery, like, instant gratification is, like, hardwired into, mm-hmm. I think, our younger generation's mind. And I probably suffer from that a lot, too. And it causes me to be frustrated about certain things. But it's, as you age and you experience things, you realize there aren't really many shortcuts in life.
No.
You know? And the flukes, as much as flukes do happen, that's a edge margin case.
Yeah.
And most of the time, it's the 10,000 plus hours of dedication. You're eating shit for years. People are telling you shouldn't paint the way you should. People are telling you shouldn't start that business. And all of a sudden, the moment matches you. Yeah. You never match the moment, but the moment just caught up to whatever it is you're doing.
Exactly.
And quote, success is found. And I think that's like a truth of life.
And success is not a permanent state. Like, success is it's a wave. And for artists, for anyone creative, if you are constantly at the top of your game, and you can be at the top, I mean, you can be at the top of your game, like, do the best you do, but if you're constantly recognized for being at the top of your game, what happens to everyone else? Like, and how does anyone move forward? And how do you move forward if you're not challenged?
It's kind of boring in a way, right?
Like, and you don't even want it after a while. You're like,
right.
I'm pretty sure Jeff Koons wakes up some mornings and he's like, why the fuck does everyone know me? Like, maybe I want to, like, just paint a fucking portrait, which is just a portrait, but I have to like go do this instead today. Right.
I don't think he can paint, but yeah.
If he could paint, yes, I think he would want to.
Well, I think that's interesting because there's a lot of art. This made me think of something that is extremely normalized in the art world, which is artists, painters in particular, that don't even make their own paintings anymore. And if you were to follow the red thread of art history, you'd be like, okay, yeah, Heldy, no shit, duh. And
well, explain that for people too, actually.
Well, I mean, I would say that pop art, which, you know, in Andy Warhol, especially like the factory, the easily producibleness and replication of that type of imagery, because Andy Warhol in particular had such a heavy influence on the trajectory of Western art history, it has become incredibly normalized to the point that it's at today, where many, many, many artists, you know, people whose names I will not name, who are supposed to be so famous for like painting these incredible portraits of people or whatever, and then you find out like, oh, they don't know how to paint skin texture. They have a whole team for that. Or it's a lot of like paint by numbers. And then you find out, oh, and then a lot of that initial imagery came from a photograph. So it's like the photograph, I mean, maybe their art is the wealth accumulation to get them to that point. And that's a different kind of art, you know, mm-hmm. to be able to just be a studio manager, boss, product manager, right? And there are a lot of these artists who don't a lot. And actually, I'm starting to find out they're getting younger and younger.
But how is that different than, you know, the guilds of the Renaissance? Is, I guess, devil's advocate.
To play devil's advocate, but those people were there.
They knew how to paint.
Well, they knew how to paint. They were also, they were learning under that particular artist. That particular artist was like their master, quote unquote, you know, like it was their master who they painted under.
His apprenticeship.
And they were painting in very, very strict and rigid. It's not like contemporary art now where, you know, Hibba paints this way and Jonas Wood paints this way and Cecily Brown paints this way. It's like they were painting within very strict traditions of art. Brand so there man. Wasn't great deviation. There was, it was very specific. Whereas there's a lot of contemporary artists, and this got very popular around the time of Andy Warhol and the idea of the factory in particular, where it was like, you know, Andy Warhol, yeah, he could draw and paint, but at a certain point, he wasn't even touching those screen prints or making them and then painting on top of them. There was an entire, literally, factory churning this stuff out, and it was all known under the umbrella brand of Andy Warhol. And that happens a lot. And then there's artists like Hibba, or like another artist who I just had to the house the other day, who, you know, we were talking and she was just like, yeah, the idea of even having like a painting assistant freaks me out because I'm a control freak and I want things exactly a certain way, and I'd rather paint slow, and if the fuck up, quote unquote fuck up happens, it's my fuck up to my cross to bear. It's mine to own and to decide if it is or is not, as opposed to like paint by numbers. Like, all right, guys, now remember that painting that I showed you a mock-up of? Yeah, we're gonna do that, but it's gonna be 18 instead of 18 inches of something I printed out for you. We're gonna do it, you know, 18 feet by 12 feet wide, and it needs to be museum quality because, you know, it's going to a blue chip gallery. And then the artist walks out of the room because he's gonna go tell his other teams to do this project and that project. And I mean, to bring this back to you, you're definitely, Hiba, not an artist that I can imagine, no matter how rich and famous your art
devotion
became. I can't imagine you being the guru of the devotion where you let other people sort of practice your devotion on your behalf.
I can't imagine it either. I mean, I never say never about anything right in life, but I can't imagine it. Just because I love what I do. If that changed one day, that would be really sad, emotionally. Or if there was a reason that I couldn't do it. Even then, I feel like if it's my painting, I would have to find a way to make them my own. I do feel like a lot of artists don't have that, though. Like, they might be more attached to a whole different process of it, like especially where photographers and painting crosses. I think some of those artists are often more involved in the photography aspect and staging and taking those pictures, and those images are translated into paintings, and they have studios where they have a vision for that, but then they also have like a space where other people are executing it. And yeah, that's not who I am right now.
So to wrap up with a final question for you, Hip, what advice would you have for up-and-coming artists? You're someone who persevered during your early days in New York to now having international shows with huge galleries. What is something you've learned along the way that you would like to impart on the up-and-coming artist class?
My younger sister just started art school back home. And at the dinner table when I was in Karachi, she was like, oh, this artist, you know, can you believe, like, she doesn't make her own work and all these people, and they're, like, starving. This is in Karachi, and she doesn't pay them properly, and this, like, it's so physical, and there's so much, like, labor involved. And I was like, you can't get angry about it. You can't put your energy into thinking about what another artist who's like in her 50s probably is doing and why it pisses you off. Because you're right, it has nothing to do with you. And she's like, but it's not even good. And I was like, you're giving all this like emotional energy, which is actually creative energy, to someone in the art world who's pissed you off. Mm-hmm. And you're giving them all this emotional space. You need to like reclaim it, and you need to put it into what you're doing, because it's too much. Like, you're giving too much of yourself, and you need to give that to what you're making, because you're like in art school, and get your own shit together. Who cares what anyone else is doing? Right?
Comparison's the thief of joy.
Yeah, no, totally. That's... And so, and my shaman told me, yes, this is a weird situation. He said, to judge someone is to be blind.
Right.
So if someone is looking at you and they're like, oh, this girl is like, she's weird. She's from Karachi. She's always wearing these dresses. She's sitting on her work and painting. Like, what the fuck is wrong with her? I've gotten all these questions, which is why I'm putting them out there. And they'll all have a different thought about why I'm doing that. and without actually knowing the truth. And we all project a bit of who we are onto other people, right? And we expect that other artist to meet us, like to meet us in the space where we are. But every artist is so unique. Like this one is completely crazy. This girl right here, where did you find her? But I
at Christie's one night, honestly.
I know. I heard.
How ironic.
I heard that you tried to slide into her DMs first. Like you tried to friend her.
Cut. We're going to cut this. We're going to cut this.
I was there for the entire situation.
You said try to slide into the DMs. How about successfully slid into the DMs?
And then you just like found her.
I said, excuse me, do we actually know each other? And then you did not respond.
And then you were like, oh, yeah.
You're Jerry Gagosian. What do you mean?
You're like the girl I texted the other day.
Yeah. Well, I sent out a group blast, an algorithm.
Yeah.
I'm kidding. That story is for another podcast.
How we met.
Yeah. So, I mean, I know those are a bit like not mainstream thoughts, but those are also the ones that I found have stolen my joy. And my energy.
You meditate every day?
I do, because if I didn't, I would go bitch slapping people. Like,
what? And do you think that, because what you just said actually really opened my mind to something, because, you know, as Dr. Nitpick and Professor Know-It-All here, over here.
Cultural commentator.
Yeah.
That's what I call hers.
I feel like, you know, I've listened to a lot of different gurus speak over, you know, over my lifetime. And I feel like I have a decent handle on, like, mindfulness to an extent, like, in the abstract. But I never thought of the idea that, like, you know, you need to sort of learn how to redirect that emotional reaction, which might be really visceral and feel out of control and out of your hands. Like your sister felt like indignation, like moral indignation, emotional indignation, like disgust, frustration. And then you're like, you know, whipping her like a guru, being like, no, like you have to think, you have to, like, that's not even your problem. And actually there is, of course, the cliche, like, other people's opinion of me is none of my business and all of those types of ideas, and they go both ways.
Another Hallmark card.
Hallmark card. Also a phrase from AA, another phrase I heard in AA, which I think about a lot, but I also didn't think about it that I would be like giving up creativity. Mm-hmm. Because for me, as I think I fall under the umbrella of the cliche artist who has to suffer in order to drive myself into like that place of like, I have to be morally outraged, or like I have to be so frustrated and back up against the wall and feel something so strongly that I must go I have to go change the fabric of time and space and fix this sin in the universe, you know? And then that's like when I go in and try to rewrite something. And I've always thought sort of some of my anger, my frustration is the thing that drives me. And I don't know if it's self-discipline, but I don't know if I could do what you just said.
I see that. People are different, and there are people who would need a driver like that. For me, it's the opposite. If I'm giving too much emotional energy to something else, I my paintings are never as good. And that's just how my flow state works. But also your indignation and angst, teenage angst, comes from the fact that you care so much. Like, you care a lot. You're deeply protective of artists. You see everything. I see like 2%. Like, people have to point out the elephant in the room for me to even see it. Someone could be standing there cursing the shit out of me and I won't even notice. I'll just like think they're talking on their phone. I don't always notice things in my environment or happening in the larger world around me. But you care more. You just do. You care about what happened in Ukraine, how it translated into Venice, how that affected the women who are working right now, what you could do about it. And that's who you are. And that's what I love about you, is that you give a shit. I mean, if you didn't give a shit, you would be a very different person. So I don't know if I would call it.
And if you gave a shit, you'd be a really different person.
Yeah, but I will never give a shit.
And on that, ladies and gentlemen.
Hiba, it's been a pleasure.
Thank you.
So what are you up to? Where can people find you? What? It's so awkward because you're like my friend for me to ask you to plug stuff, but what's going on?
People can find me in my studio.
Always and forever.
My Instagram.
I'm disrespectfully eating kettle chips.
She's shadow banned.
No.
I'm so shadow banned that the other day the receptionist of my facialist was like, I tried to show someone your work and I put in your full name, but you never came up.
Wait, you're shadow banned on Instagram?
I've been shadow banned for a year. Like, I've lost thousands of followers. I'm thinking of joining TikTok. I'm not even going to lie. So they can basically find me in my studio. Apparently, I have a presence on Artsy, which has very little information on it.
How about any projects you're working on?
I have a show up right now with Almin in Paris up until April 8th. Mm-hmm. And after that, I have a painting in this girls' group show. The first part is opening tonight. Some really great artists, Jordan Castile, Robin Williams.
Wow.
In the next one, there is me, which is all you need.
Ta-da.
And client. There's a lot of really good artists. Gisella's in it.
Oh, fun.
So, yeah. And
Gisella
I
McDaniels.
Yeah,
nice.
Gisella's in it. So that's opening today at Flag Art Foundation, and that's going to be a two-part show. So if anyone wants to check out a lot of paintings by women artists, they should head down to Flag.
We'll link the event information in this podcast description. So
yeah.
Amazing. Jerry.
Well, as always, if you aren't a subscriber to Gagosian.com, you're missing out on the better commentary, which is my writing, which is for those of you who don't know what writing is, it's like a meme but longer. And so I write about art, the art market. It's my personal blog post to talk shit about Hiba. It's Gagosian/ burn book Bishop. It's where I keep a personal diary of all the times she doesn't answer me and how it makes me feel when I call her. And
she's
she
busy mastering oil painting.
And she doesn't pick up the phone.
This has never happened.
All right.
Anyway, no. Just head on over there for an even more thorough explanation of what the art world is and how it should be, according to me.
Perfect. And on that note, this has been Art Smack episode 20.
Thanks, Matt.
Make sure you review and like on iTunes or Spotify. Give us 5 stars, please. That really helps. We're an independent podcast. All right. See you guys later.
See you on the internet.